My journey has been one of returning from the darkness and stepping out into the light once more. I'm Chance Lunsford. I'm also Logos Centrifugal. While you're sitting trying to figure that out, this is my podcast. Allegedly. Logos Centrifugal Podcast. I'm Chance Lunsford. I'm also Logos Centrifugal. Maybe you're also Logos Centrifugal. While you're trying to figure out how to pronounce it, let me welcome today's esteemed guest. I have with me the man, the myth, the shadow, Dr. Sean McFate. Welcome back. Third time you've been on the show. I think besides maybe one other guy, that's a record. So,
well, I like your show, Chance. It's really fun to be back.
Well, I'm always glad to have you on. And we have a little bit of a exciting reason to bring you back on today because you have a book launching on Tuesday, High Treason. I've actually been digging into the book. I haven't gotten all the way through it. I just had it a couple of days, but I'm digging it. And I'm excited to talk about it and talk about some of the themes and ideas in there beyond just the story. Although let's get into that too. But with that, why don't you just do a better job than I would of filling in the blanks of who you are and what you do in addition to writing works of fiction.
Yeah, thanks. I can do fiction with air quotes. My name is Dr. Sean McFate. I have had career ADD. I started off as a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne Division, U.S. Army, and then I went to the dark side, if you will. I became a private military contractor, some would say a mercenary, working for mostly as a U.S. paramilitary, really is what I was doing, in Africa and other places, and then got out, and now I'm a professor of war. At National Defense University, Georgetown University. I'm a think tank. But what I like to do is I love to write. So I write nonfiction and also write fiction. And High Treason is a novel. It's a fiction novel, like a wonderful beach read, but it's really thinly veiled reality. And I take what I've seen in the world of war and I put it into fiction because sometimes fiction is a better truth teller than nonfiction.
Sure, because I think sometimes a measure of a bit of information's factualness is how well it actually ingrains the fact that you're trying to convey into the mind that kind of takes it in. And I think that's something you're really good at. You know, with your previous book, The New Rules of War, man, I have pumped that to just about everybody I know because you wrote it in a way that's easily digestible. But every page I just find myself going, huh. Man, I can look out at the world and I can't really see it the same after reading the book. And I'm noticing a lot of the same stuff in High Treason as I'm reading through it. I read through it and I go, okay, this doesn't seem like it's just pulled from thin air. And there's so many parallels with, I mean, it's not as overt as rhyming somebody's name with something or like this, but you're like, right. Okay, I'm kind of getting the picture here. And I know this is a guy who has lived in this world. And so for me, having previous knowledge of who you are makes reading this book more exciting and more interesting because I don't get the BS vibe coming from you.
Right. So this book, this novel, High Treason, is not a work of pure imagination. I mean, so most novelists are sitting in, I guess they're in their sort of like COVID state all the time, right? When they're sitting in pajamas and in their basement writing up a novel or writing up a show for Netflix or whatever. This book is, it's grounded on real life stuff that's happening. And it's really kind of about it takes place in Washington. First of all, it's part of a series. I have a novel called the Tom Locke series. And it's basically, Tom Locke is me, how I stayed in the paramilitary world and not left. And he's a lot more badass than me and a lot more damaged than me. And the series in some ways about him trying to reclaim his soul. And this is the third book in the series, but you don't have to read the prior books. This book completely stands alone, High Treason. And in this book, he's kind of like an exile. So he's the end of the second book. You don't need to know this, but he's being, you know, the Arab states are after him for different reasons. So he's hiding out in the safest place he can think of, which is Tel Aviv. And then a big explosion happens in downtown Washington, D.C. Huge. And people, like, it's the biggest terrorist attack since 9/11. A senior American official is killed, assassinated. And everybody's like, oh, it's ISIS 2.0 or something like that. And he sees this on television and says, no, that was done by my former employer, a big private military company, and they're making it look like terrorists. And the book then goes from there. And also at the same time, there's another character too. We'll get into her a bit. Her name is Jennifer Lynn. But so the book, as he goes back to Washington, he's chased by the bad guys. He's chased by the CIA and FBI, but also it's a window into how our government functions in crisis. So it takes you to the National Security Council. It takes you inside the DOD tank. It takes you inside of all these places, how they think, what they get right, what they get wrong, stuff like that.
Now, I know for people who are writing certain books, and maybe you're in this category, but like Jocko Willink, for instance, has to send his stuff in to be approved and make sure he's not divulging tactically relevant information in his books. And is that something you have to go through when you're writing something like this?
I do. And High Treason did. I hold top secret security clearance. So I had to have it go in front of the publishing board in the Pentagon. And it delayed it. It was a pain. But I'm very careful not to reveal sources and methods as I write. And I also, I don't wear that at my wrist. Like some writers lead with that, say, hey, this stuff, you know, I have security clearances and this is, I don't do that. I think that's inappropriate, but it was reviewed. There are no sources or methods revealed. I come as close as I can get, responsibly, to allow the reader insight without crossing any lines.
You know, I've recently been writing through a character I call the court jester, and just sort of saying things that there's a scene and there's a time and a place in which they're taking place that adds an element of humor to them, but they're quite, you know, striking, I guess. And I think when you write a work of fiction like this, it's, you don't even need to necessarily convey specifics or names or methods. You convey a principle, and the people who understand the principle underlying it will then mentally develop a framework in which they can behave under that principle.
Right.
And I know a lot of your work is, and what is important to you, and you kind of talked about your character, Tom Locke, saving his soul, and you've been putting this message out, and you've been putting it in every ear that will kind of listen to you, that we need to look at the way the world operates a little differently, because changes have been here, and here's my evidence, and here's where the progression of that leads. And I've also seen that, and I wish you'd listen to me. And do you feel like maybe on top of enjoying the writing and everything like that, because you can't write a book if you don't enjoy writing, because it takes a lot of work. But do you feel like maybe this is a way of reaching out to somebody who might be more metaphorically minded versus literally minded, and kind of two halves of the same service you're trying to provide?
Yes. And I'm glad you raised that. So, first of all, I write serious nonfiction, and I also write fun fiction, and not many people can do that well. And it's strange. I mean, cause, there's a reason why people can't do that well. Your brain works differently somehow. And so when I finished New Rules of War, which is a serious nonfiction book, I picked up High Treason, and I thought I would take a week to transition. It took me 3 months, right? Just, it's like more than switching a language. It's kind of hard to, how, as you described, you know, your brain is going from analytical thinking to metaphorical thinking. And it's a lot tougher than people think. And that's also why you don't see much crossover. But the reason I do it, first of all, I love it, which is, you have to enjoy it, labor of love. Second is that the New Rules of War, my last nonfiction book, which is being read widely. In fact, I just was briefing the book to a secret, quote unquote, secret unit in Fort Meade yesterday, virtually. The book's being read a lot inside the national security establishments, not just within our country, but other countries too, especially Western Europe, Pacific Rim. And that universe, it portrays a universe, an alternative way to think about international relations, war and peace, in ways that are completely different than the DC consensus, the Washington consensus. And I kind of feel like I'm Noah and it's starting to rain, you know? I mean, not to be too grandiose about it, but like I'm trying to make people stop and think about what they assume the future will be versus what it might actually be. And then the book High Treason is a novel version of The New Rules of War. It tells a very similar message, but I use the medium of fiction, of characters and scenes that are fun with a high octane pace to keep the pages turning, right? And James Patterson, who's a New York Times like number one author, right? I didn't know, but he actually got his hands on a copy of the book, of the galley, and he loved it. He said it's better than Tom Clancy. Tom Clancy for our era. So it is, people start to see it. And it's trying to reach different audiences than The New Rules of War. So fiction is magical, but it's more than just magical thinking. It can actually pull back the curtain on a way to understand international relations that you wouldn't normally think about.
You know, Tom Clancy's books were fun to read. And his thinking was certainly influenced by a certain collection, I guess we'll call them, of people who thought about the world a certain way. And I like to think of this as sort of like a Muhammad Ali versus George Foreman fight, where your way of thinking is more like Muhammad Ali. It's agile, it's fleet, it's fast, and it's trying to use clever tactics, because George Foreman was one of the strongest, meanest guys to ever box. But Muhammad Ali used that against him and just kind of showed people that the skill and the technical prowess and the quickness and the ability to be here, be there. And that's sort of the way I think about you in relation to Tom Clancy, is that maybe his style of writing was more just sort of giant lumbering juggernaut of doom approaching, yeah, whether it was economic or bombs or you know, nuclear disaster. And you're saying, well, that's maybe not, there's no nuclear disasters coming in that way. There might be like a dirty bomb or something, but essentially what there is little fleet things going around, because there's so many players, so many interests, so many channels to exert that through. And that's what makes it exciting for me to read, is because, like I was saying before we started recording, I look around the world and I see parallels and I go, oh, well, this new little piece of information right here suddenly makes this gear connect, and it makes things make a lot more sense. And I guess you have two other books in this series, is that right?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
Shadow Wars is the first book, and Deep Black, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, and you can repeat that here but as you've been writing this, because The New Rules of War was not your first nonfiction book either, so you've kind of been churning these things out. And I have a couple questions, and one is just sort of what kind of response have you gotten as you've progressed as an author, as you've progressed as a teacher, and how has that sort of developed your perspective on what might actually be possible? Do you feel like before you started this endeavor and then where you've gotten to now, that some world changing headway has been made, yeah, because of all this effort and time you've been putting in?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a late writer in life. I started writing after age 40. And which is one, for listeners out there, is totally doable, right? So don't feel like you're not writing at age 20 or 30, you're done. You can pick it up at any time. In fact, I think it's, in some ways, you get, for me at least, I benefited from some life experience. So What happened for me is I was trained like everybody else in the US Army and as an American, what war looks like. It's a very Tom Clancy view of the world, of super, you know, of our super high tech military versus an adversary's super high tech military, or, you know, using high tech weaponry to go after terrorists or what, and we win, right? But then when I became a paramilitary in Africa, I saw war in a completely different way that made me question all of the assumptions that I was taught as an officer in the US Army, everything I sort of absorbed as an American citizen about what war is and what international relations is. And then as I teach at the War College, I have, what the War College is that our Department of Defense has a series of war colleges that are master's giving degrees, colleges for senior officers like colonels who are going to go become admirals and generals. And a lot of these a lot of the students come from around the world. So militaries from around the world send their very best for a year to get their top soon to be generals and admirals and intelligence people, you know, this master's degree, which I teach strategy there. And they bring their world to me. So it's like having the world come to you, and they don't share secret information, but they share everything else. And it really opens my eyes between what, like we call it the Washington consensus or the blob. And that's sort of like what people in DC think the future of everything is going to be. And it's usually wrong, right? It's usually wrong. And so that they educated me about, you know, some of the, as Mark Twain said, never let school get in the way of a good education. And that is what, you know, working with these students, it was a two-way street for me. And that comes out in The New Rules of War. And my first nonfiction book was The Modern Mercenary, about how mercenaryism is like one of the biggest threats in the 21st century, our biggest security threats, not to the United States, but to the whole world, right? And that's kind of what you see in high treason. The reason it's called high treason is there's multiple ways of treason, to commit treason in the name of goodness. Some are good, some are bad. And that the way that our country is vulnerable is not from a blitzkrieg from China or Russia or something else. It's through other ways. And high treason, this novel, explains one of those ways that we're vulnerable.
Mm. You know, isn't it interesting how much influence just these massive volumes of money and power have on things, and how you can sort of watch it play out, and you can see, you know, you mentioned the blob, and I had a vivid imagination of more like a dumbbell shaped blob. Right in the middle is a hand squeezing the real way that things are going to be, and that's just the banks going. It's like that's kind of for sure right there, is money's going to be right there in the center of power, holding on to the real issues. And I guess you're a DC area guy, and you've had a lot of different experience that shows you how the power and the money flows through that place. And I guess I wonder, even with a military with maybe a more modern relevant worldview of how to operate and maybe dressed in it, you know, the equipment, the technical prowess, the way to approach a mission, all this stuff is maybe more in alignment with what you're envisioning. How much headway can they make in that new arrangement if they don't have the political backing and the money backing? Because that kind of directs a lot of that stuff. And I guess I just wonder how you figure you influence that in any significant way without being some of the money yourself.
Yeah, well, I've resisted the money myself. So yeah, Lockheed Martin's not inviting me to give high-end dinner talks. Look, so it's funny. I give briefings in the Pentagon a lot, CIA, like, you know, the unit, JSOC, SOCOM. One of the questions I am always asked is, who are you talking to on the Hill? Because there is, you know, as President Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex, right, which is like this self-licking ice cream cone between the Congress, defense industry, and the Pentagon, where they make each other demand more. And that, you know, that's President Eisenhower. And, you know, we actually have a war college in our system that specializes in defense acquisition. Guess what its name is? The Eisenhower School. So it's, I guess somebody has a sense of humor someplace. But yeah, so, you know, we're like, for example, we're buying, you know, I think I've talked about this on your show before, like the F-35 fighter jet, right? $1.5 trillion for this program. $1.5 trillion. Zero combat missions. We've been at war constantly since 9/11. Zero combat missions. We're spending more on this single seat airplane than Russia's GDP, right? That's nonsense. And yet we're buying more. And Lockheed likes it. So, and Congress likes it, because Congress, the reason why it's partly why it's so expensive is because a little bit of that plane is made in almost everybody's congressional district. as a way to, you know, to keep Congress interested. And, you know, the question is, do we even need fighter jets anymore? We already have the best. The last time we had a strategic dogfight was the Korean War. Why do we need more, especially manned ones? In fact, I argue in both the New Rules of War and the book High Treason that, you know, war has moved on from aircraft carriers and from fighter jets and from tanks. It's moved on entirely, and we don't get it. We're sort of stuck fighting the last successful war, which is World War II. Every year, I mean, it's how generals think, you know, that's the saying, like, generals always fight the last war, especially if they won it. It's World War II for the U.S. military. It's World War II for Hollywood, too. Every year, there's new movies coming out about World War II, Midway or Fury or whatever, more than all the other wars since 45 combined. So we're kind of fighting, and we're stuck in the glory days of the greatest generation, so-called. Meanwhile, our enemies are innovating past us, you know, China, Russia, Iran, and that's the danger. And when they go after us, and I think we could already be at war with Russia and or China, they're not going to come at us with, you know, carrier groups and fighter planes. They're going to come at us using these sneaky ways. Like you talked earlier about Tom Clancy, and the world I see is very Sun Tzu. So Sun Tzu is an ancient, you know, Chinese strategist from 2,500 years ago. He wrote the book Art of War, which you should read. It's easy to read. It's like chess. It's easy to read, but hard to master. Chess is easy to learn, but hard to master. But for him, war is deception. And we're living in an era where war is getting sneakier. And our adversaries are playing the sneaky, cunning game, and we are investing in brute strength. Meanwhile, we throw carrier groups into the South China Sea and think that would deter China. China is winning the South China Sea with zero carrier groups. How are they doing it, right? So the book, The New Rules of War, explains this. The novel High Treason is not about the South China Sea, but it shows you also like how a cunning adversary could get in, you know, mess us up good without any sort of military looking anything.
You know, and then it wouldn't be all that suspicious to start to wonder, well, if this is obviously a bad way of operating and it's a bad idea, kind of makes me wonder whose influence is pushing us to continue to operate this way. Seems like spending these trillions of dollars and not getting nothing from it might be a great way to sort of bleed the wealth out of a place.
Well, you know, it's funny that a lot of Americans think it's debatable that Reagan won or helped win the Cold War by getting an arms race with the Soviet Union that bankrupted the Soviet Union. And in some ways, you could sort of say China's doing that to us today, because every dollar they spend, we'll spend like a thousandfold.
Yeah.
And, you know, we spend, to give you a percentage, we spend, if you look at all the discretionary federal spending, like all the money the government spends in a year, that's up to the, you know, up to the White House, not up to like, you know, Medicare or Medicaid. Over half of it goes to the Department of Defense. Everybody else gets a small sliver of something else. Our military gets more money than the next eight biggest militaries in the world combined, including China, including Russia, including the UK, right? But still, we are spending, you know, lots and lots of money. Now, people who like Lockheed will say, well, it's only a small percent of our GDP, which is like really a false metric. Like, why does that matter, right? Like, we should be spending like 3% of our GDP on Lockheed Martin. I mean, it's a smoke and mirror. But yeah, we're spending a lot of money, but we're buying, I think, the wrong things. We need to defend ourselves, but we don't need more $13 billion aircraft carriers.
Here's a thought I had while you were speaking about that, is just the idea that, and maybe this is where some of this stuff gets into where you think about things through the fiction end, but you know, just like when the Soviet Union sort of fell, decided to be something different, I guess, but it's not like those AK-47s and MiGs and stuff just went away. They had stockpiles of them, and they're sold to this day all over the place. And the same people who had the information and, you know, were over the military and the intelligence agencies are the same people who rule Russia right now. And they, you know, it's not like they didn't profit off of all that stuff that they had sort of just taxed their nation into death over. And it's not like the stuff that the United States has built is going to just disintegrate because the United States bankrupts itself and sort of turns into a mess. And the same people who've been building them are going to be the ones who have the passwords and the technical know-how. And I'm just going to say, well, I can just sell this to you. And I guess I wonder, I know there's a big element of trying to sound certain alarms in your work. You want America and modern, decent civilization to thrive and continue to develop and to grow. And you're saying this is maybe some ways in which that could fall apart. And I keep coming back to the idea of how I've asked a lot of guests this in the past year, but just how do you feel like you're doing on that, or we as a people are doing? Do you think we're taking this brinksmanship up more and more again, like we've sort of done in the past? Because it seems like this past couple of weeks has suggested we might be. And I wonder just what, you know, we might just be looking back at Dr. McFate's books and being like, well, shit, I wish I would have listened.
Yeah.
To him, well, and more people.
I my voice is not alone. I think there's a couple ways to answer this. I work in the field of experts in Washington, D.C., many of which are just groupthink. They're not really experts. Think of like seventh grade, you know, with cliques of people, cliques of ideas. And there's not many independent thinkers. And I'll tell you why, is because you don't get rewarded as an independent thinker in Washington. You go there and you fight for, you know, the blue side or the red side or something like that, you know? And even within the Pentagon, there are little groups of people and stuff like that who they're powerful groups of people who want, you know, they think the future is aircraft carriers. They think the future is, you know, robots and AI or whatever. I'm not in those, you know, if you're truly an independent thinker, which I think we all have a responsibility to do it in a democracy, you'll find that you're not part of a team like that. You might be touching several teams. But when I say things that don't cleave to their orthodoxy, I am deemed a heretic. And that's Cassandra's curse. So Cassandra, as you know from ancient Greek mythology, she was a princess, and the gods gave her the gift of prophecy, but the curse that no one would believe her. I sometimes feel like I'm Cassandra. So in this book, I don't want to give any spoilers, but it turns out the bad guys are not who you think they are. And they may not even be a state. And we're getting to a point now where the Fortune 100 are more powerful than most states in the world. You know, there's 190 states in the world, give or take. And, you know, when ExxonMobil goes to Africa, is the Gabon going to be more powerful simply because Gabon is a state and ExxonMobil is not? No, of course not. And these, now that we're seeing a rise of mercenaries in the world, and these are high-end mercenaries. I mean, some are jokes, like Goudreau in Venezuela, who was a very good Green Beret, but a very terrible, you know, mercenary guy. But there are very able ones. And this is rising. And what mercenaries do is they allow you to fight wars in secret, so they give you plausible deniability. They also are cheaper than most militaries and more effective, it can be, and they can be hired by anybody. So, you know, the 0.001% or the Fortune 500 or whomever, these are global entities, and now they have national security interests, and they could rent private security, you know, private armies, private special operations forces, private CIAs for their own purposes, no matter how petty. And if that happens, and it's happening, it's going to change the world of international relations as we know it. Because the world that we learn about in sixth grade is that nation states rule the world. You know, they're the geopolitical unit that determines governance around the world. That world is fading. And what follows it is going to look much more chaotic. It's going to look much more, not Mad Max, a Thunderdome, but it's not going to look like diplomacy and war as we grew up thinking about it. And it's going to, and the winners will be either brute forces or, but also the cunning can win. It's like the Sun Tzuian way of war. And that's what the book High Treason shows you. You don't have to be the toughest guy or gal in the room. You just got to be the smartest. And we're entering a world where wits matter.
You can see a lot of those themes on social media right now. I mean, if you know to look for it, it's very remarkable because I brought up Muhammad Ali and George Foreman earlier, but imagine if Muhammad Ali had been able to convince George Foreman to punch himself in the face until he was battered and bloody and knocked himself out. And that's kind of what we're seeing a lot on social media is there are people who have mastered the art of communication in a sort of harmful way where they can divide groups and then have these new divided groups just turn in and start fighting themselves. And I've watched it a right. whole bunch of times and it's remarkable. And then I look at it on a small scale, you know, the people I'm connected with, or then a little broader scale where I've had the good fortune to talk to people who are influential like you and a whole bunch of other people because of this platform. And I watch what happens to them and sort of map those things. And on a larger scale or a more influential scale like you live in or some of these other people, you see how those tides ripple out and have great ramifications. And I guess that's the one thing that sort of makes me feel like even though we are headed towards a sort of a new paradigm and we're already in the midst of one and our thinking's just catching up, I think it's probably more accurate.
Yeah.
I do see a lot more people catching on to certain things. And maybe they're a decade behind, but it's promising that I feel like once you catch on to a certain couple of things and people call this red pilling or whatever you want to think about it, but there's a certain chain of understanding that happens. And once you have a first couple pieces, it's inevitable that if you return to that chain of thought, it develops along a certain arc and it might have branches and everything. Like I might disagree with you about something, but I can see the arc and I can go, well, that's an arc right there. And then maybe your coordinates are a little different than mine. So I guess taking that ramble into consideration, I wonder, so you've got three books in this series and you said it was Shadow War. And what's the next one?
Deep Black.
Deep Black.
Yeah.
And then High Treason. Yeah. And, as you've developed through these different fictional scenarios with a lot of backdrop, I wonder, do you look back at your work now and can you point to instances where maybe some of the themes that you have been developing have real world correlates? So maybe people can find some of that value in what you're doing. Yeah.
So yeah, there's so many. Well, first of all, I completely agree with you on your rambles, you said. and there's interest, there's an intellectual insurgency being bred inside the military within strategists that see this, that, rather than you fighting George Foreman, how awesome would it be if you can convince George Foreman just to give up before the fight, right? And that's Sun Tzu, is that the zenith of skill as a strategist is that you win before the first shot is fired through cunning and deception and whatever else. And so one of the things that's come up is like 10 years ago, I was screaming on desks that mercenaries were returning, that the people, they've been outlawed for a very long time, for at least 150 years. And we grew up thinking about mercenaries as, cartoonish villains in Bond movies and stuff like that. I'm like, no, they're here, they're resurrecting, and it's going to change everything. That could just change war. It's going to change who has power in international relations, because now the super rich will someday become superpowers if all they have to do is swipe a check, right? And whether that's oligarchs or narco lords or Bill Gates or ExxonMobil, whatever. I mean, all those could now become armed and dangerous. And 10 years ago, people laughed at me like, this is stupid. This is just sensationalism. And then things started. Then I wrote Shadow War, which is about Tom Locke, who's working as a high-end mercenary. And that book pulls back the curtain on what real mercenaries do these days. And since then, the last 10 years, now mercenaries are, people are like, yeah, mercenaries are here. They're actually a big thing. I mean, in 2018, we had Russia uses mercenaries all the time now. There's one group called the Wagner Group, and they had 500 Wagner Group guys, mercenaries, who are not all Russian, by the way. They're just Russian-speaking mercenaries. The top leadership is pretty cemented to the GRU, which is Russia's military intelligence wing. But the rank and file are from all over the Russian-speaking world. And they went up against 500 of our most elite soldiers in Syria in secret in February of 2018. They went up against Delta, Rangers, Green Berets, and some Marines. And there was a battle. And in that battle, our best troops were in the defensive, so it's a stronger position, called in our best aviation, B-52s, F-15s, AC-130 gunships, drones, you name it. And it still took our best troops and our best aviation 4 hours to beat back 500 mercenaries, right? That's how powerful mercenaries are these days. What happens when they have to face 5,000 mercenaries? What happens when it's not Delta Force, but like the Virginia National Guard, right? Mm-hmm. Mercenaries are no kidding, real threat. They're not these cartoonish figures we think about. And now people are starting to see it. In fact, The Economist just this past week had an article of asking, like, is the taboo against mercenaries over? And so that's where I was 10 years ago. And everybody laughed at me then. And now, they're kind of where I am. They've come up, they've caught up. And I think a lot of the world sees a lot of our adversaries, like Russia uses mercenaries a lot. And meanwhile, we're like, that's dishonorable. We can't use them. And I'm not saying that we should, but they are now a tool of warfare that give plausible deniability in an era of secret warfare. And that's why they're so, and it's not just them, it's other things like, information, disinformation campaign. In fact, the Russian guy who owns the Wagner Group also runs the troll factory in Russia. So these types of warfare is getting sneaky. And weapons that give you plausible deniability, that generate disinformation, that's how you win. In the old rules of war, it's battlefield victory. Think of Waterloo or Gettysburg or Berlin or Stalingrad, Midway. That's how you used to win old types of war, conventional war, Tom Clancy war. In modern war, it's convincing George Foreman to punch himself in the face. You do it in a cunning, sneaky way. And the logic is this. Who cares about the sword if you can manipulate the arm that wields it? And high treason shows you that.
Well, number one, I think to myself every time I talk to you that I'm probably getting added to new lists. And number two, I'm thinking about how to word what I want to say. Maybe I'll come back to that. I think I don't quite have rounded out my thought. So let's come back to the book a little bit, because we've been talking a lot of, sort of theory and stuff like that. But I'm reading through it and I told you this before we started, but it's very informationally dense. I feel like I'm picking up useful information in most of the sentences, or at least the paragraphs that I'm reading. And I'm about 50 pages in, is as far as I've gotten. So it's really just sort of setting a scene, and there's a lot of cool stuff that happens. Your guy's got a lot of pizzazz. I like the character Tom Locke. He's kind of a funny guy. And he's that sort of devil may care attitude is always it's fun to read a character like that who just is like, all right, only I can do this. and then it's off into battle. And I guess I'm wondering how much of that character lives within you, and how much of that character is just because it is like that, it just sort of gets your blood up and makes it more fun to read through.
Well, it's funny. I mean, the book is, it's a fast paced book, and it's a fun book that, if I've done my job well, you put it down, you're like, it makes me think about a couple of things after I enjoyed seeing it. Like a good movie. You watch a good movie, like, it's a good movie. And then you're driving home or you're going someplace else. You're like, you're cool thinking about that movie. And I want High Treason. I think High Treason, that's what I was shooting for as an author. And, Tom Locke started off as me. So I started, it was based on a memoir I was writing about something I had done in Africa for the U.S. government. And then my editor or my agent came to me and said, look, you can't do that. You're going to, be sued to death by the U.S. government. And he was right. And I thought I was being careful, but he's like, no, let's turn it to fiction. And Tom Locke was me. And then it got, and then it launched a series, right? And now Tom Locke, how he's evolved is a little bit beyond me. And he is questioning his life choices when we meet him in the beginning of High Treason. He's thinking he's skidded out in life, basically. And he doesn't know what the next steps are. And then he sees this thing happen in Washington. And he says, you know what? I believe in this. I may have left my country, or they may have left me, but God damn it, if somebody's going to attack, you know, our homeland, and I know who is actually really behind it, and the authorities don't, and that's by design. Think of like the Sun Tzu way of war, deception. It's a frame or be framed world, and he thinks that this private military company that used to hire him, that basically screwed him over, is behind this. He recognizes, at least he thinks he recognizes, their telltale signs. And he's like, only I can stop this, because if this goes further, then it'll be too late. There could be, you know, think about this. What would happen if there was a palace coup done in the White House with a private military company orchestrating it, right? And it's financial backers. And that's part of the premise of this novel, is like, then suddenly you can auction off the Oval Office for real. And this company used to work for, think of, it's like Blackwater meets Goldman Sachs, right? It's like this really high-end, sophisticated organization. And so he comes back, like, you know, locked and loaded. And it also explains how he comes back, which is interesting. That's how you actually do it. And so some of the book is fun. Some of it's like, you know, devil may care. But some of the tradecraft in the book is real. Some of the politics in the book are real. And the question about what does treason even look like today and would we recognize it is real.
When you talk about that, one thing that stood out to me is you said that you could auction off the Oval Office, and that's after you sort of initiate a palace coup by the military in the U.S. And I was just sort of inwardly smirking, because it's like, well, you mean like the rest of the world that we do that to, or participate in the game that ends up doing that to people? And it makes me think of Pearl Harbor in a certain sense, this book, because it's like, you mean they can, or 9/11, they can do that here? It was different when we were the shining city on the hill and we just kind of took bombs off of the hill every once in a while when the ruffians were misbehaving. But you can bring a bomb here. You can bring a coup here. And I guess I wonder along those lines, how much you think maybe that's already been done a bunch of times by the way that money influences how politics work.
Well, you know, Cicero said that money is the sinews of war, right? And that's the relationship between war and money is ancient and very human. And the defense oligarchy and the beltway oligarchy we have in our country is a big part of the problem. You asked this question earlier. I mean, not everybody's in the defense industry is evil, but I think we have a couple of these huge companies like Lockheed and Raytheon and others who have a lot of sway on Capitol Hill, and they make the military buy things it doesn't need or want, right? And then once you have those things, you kind of have to fight war according to those things, which is a really dumb way to fight war, but that's where we are. But it also, to this point, we also have this vision about what war would be like. And that vision, I say, is wrong. And High Treason, to your point, shows you that we are vulnerable and that some of the best weapons don't fire bullets. And so what's going on, you know, in High Treason, it takes place mostly in Washington, D.C., and it really lifts the lid off of Washington. It's seedy underbelly from Capitol Hill to K Street. There's private military companies. There's also private intelligence firms, like private CIAs, different interests, and people also with their, in my opinion, highly contorted sense of patriotism, this Machiavellian sense of patriotism, where they think a little harm can for a great good is worth it, and not realizing the unintended consequences of that. And so there's a couple of characters in here, like a national security advisor and others who really believe that they're patriots, but actually they're quite deluded. And I know it's dangerous waters when you start to get in people's motives, but that's what fiction allows you to do versus nonfiction, is that you can really explore character types. And one of the character types is the person you know, with the best intentions going off to do the worst things.
So I guess that brings me to another line of questioning, which is you write about a scenario in this book without giving too much away, where this company does a thing here and it initiates a certain chain of events, and maybe the event is extreme, right? But to what extent, I feel like I know the answer to this to a certain extent already, but to what extent would you say that things that are not some major, maybe kinetic event changing the course of things, but how many of these operations are already just taking place here? I mean, I guess what I'm getting at, and it's tied into the last question, is how much of just the money being spent in these private organizations is just exactly that? Because here's a better way of saying it. The military mercenaries are people who are the best at it and are reconciled to the idea that they're going to be killing people, and they're all right with that. And that draws a certain kind of people, like the military in general. There's just people who are trying to go to college or who are patriots or who don't have a lot of options left. And maybe they're not super soldiers, but when a guy can make a whole bunch of money to go be a super soldier and he's good at it and he likes it, that creates a different kind of thing. And that's becoming more and more legitimate. But the business of words and of influence and of these different kind of things, I mean, we say DC is one thing, but like you were saying, it's these different groups of people who are really good at information warfare, who are really good at writing bills in a way that they can slide in a whole bunch of pork and all different kinds of things and doing dark things that people don't need to know about, and where to put the money and find the money and all this kind of stuff. And I guess even though they might be a legitimate company or whatever, there are people who are undergoing operations on U.S. soil to influence politics, to influence a lot of decisions. And I guess I'm wondering how much of that is just overt war on our own soil, do you think? And how much of that do you, because you said there are patriots, but that they're warped in their perspective on it, on how to do right. This. I guess I'm just wondering how, it seems like that's all of it, at least on the national level.
I mean, it's a great question, Chance. I mean, there's a question of, hey, there's tons of corruption. We know that, right? Now, is corruption equal to war? I don't know. Is it equal to war if it's being pushed by outside forces who want to see the U.S. collapse? Maybe so, right? So let's step away a little bit from there's two answers. One is that private military companies or these mercenary corporations are an offshoot of the military-industrial complex. They are the natural conclusion to the military-industrial complex. It began as an industry that made products for the military to use, and it ended up with the military, you know, this industry creating services, including trigger pulling services. And then where does that end? It ends with them finding new clients. So like, look at Eric Prince. He founded Blackwater. And then when that stopped for him in Nisour Square in Iraq in 2007, which a bunch of Blackwater guys killed Iraqi civilians, he left the U.S. and now he works for China in Africa doing things that arguably are against U.S. interests, right? So you don't know. That's the thing about mercenaries, is like, where is the loyalty to the, it's only to the paycheck. And then the other question is this idea of, if you really want to collapse the United States of America, if you don't go to war like it's World War II and invade the shores of California or the Carolinas, what you do is you reach in through modern technology and information and you create dissent so that the country collapses from the inside, right? So, and that's kind of what's going on right now. Right now we have a culture war in our country. You know, red states versus blue states, Democrats versus Republicans, CNN versus Fox, whatever, right? That's fine. We know democracies are messy. If it's a family feud, we'll find a way through it. We've been here before. but it's not what's going on. You have countries like Russia, China, and others who are reaching in and finding the seams in our social fabric and pulling them apart, fanning those flames, doing whatever they can to accelerate our own descent. We are our own worst enemy. They're just helping us along the path. That's a much more, that's a war strategy. It doesn't involve tanks or aircraft carriers. It involves other types of weapons and other types of methods. And this is the Sun Tzu, you know, teaching George Foreman to punch himself in the face strategy.
It's almost, you know, I've been reading through the book American Prometheus about Robert Oppenheimer. And, you know, I come away thinking both he probably, you know, the authors make it clear, sort of, they don't hide their political opinions very well, which is fine and everything. But I come away thinking he was a very independent man who probably told a lot of people what he thought they needed to hear. It seems like who he was. But, you know, I guess I just wonder, it's almost unavoidable that I guess the question is, at what point does it become conveying your opinion and trying to exert what might be considered lawful influence versus something, because it's overt in your book, but I think the question is inherent in what you're saying is, at what point does it become treasonous to do what you're doing in this way? Is it that you shall know them by their fruits? I mean, well, by the time you get to where the direction that they took us goes, do we have to hang some people because of the things that they've done, or how do you even recognize when that line has been crossed?
Right.
And how do you even frame that question effectively?
Well, this is one of the most important questions of modern warfare, right? Because modern warfare is, when it's done well, is disguises itself as war, it's as not war, right? And that's how it wins. And by the time, it's sort of the boiling frog slowly strategy, by the time you figure it out, it might be too late. So the question we should have, our national discourse, which I'm trying and others are trying to create with my books and other people doing different things, is the question that you ask. It's not how many F-35s are needed. It's these questions, like, how do we know? You know, war is getting epistemological. What that means is that epistemology is the study of knowing what is truth from what is not truth. War is getting epistemological, where deception is more decisive in battlefield than you know, war, bullets in battlefields. So creating information, misinformation, creating the fog of war so everybody distrusts everything, that's weaponizing something. And so this is the question that you ask, for which I don't have an easy answer, other than saying that's precisely the national discourse we should be having about American defense strategy.
It's almost, I look at the world and I see not just the idea of a Big Bang war, but of a culture war moving out of a certain era too, because I think of Gramscian sort of Long March cultural Marxism. And that was where you had an existing culture and then you would use these clever elements to sort of push and tangle and then to push the other elements out. And that worked really well in a lot of places, including right here. But it seems like the new evolution of that is, what if we took one false culture or destructive culture, and then we bred another destructive culture, and then we just had them fight each other and totally collapse a nation without even trying to say how we feel about it? We'll just let them destroy themselves, and then we'll just reap the profits. We'll buy all this equipment that they made on the real cheap, and then our private military guys can buy these from us, and they can go run missions or rent them or whatever, but the U.S. Right. won't have it, and then they'll no longer be able to push around. And, you know, I guess I wonder, what do you think the balance is there between the cultural elements and then just the sort of ever-present money and people who want to incite these kind of things?
Well, I think
what I'm asking is, you go ahead. I think you're...
No, well, for the strategy that you've outlined is a viable modern war strategy, right? You foment in secret a culture war they weaken themselves, they collapse, and then you can have your own elements go in there, and you can use American private military or other private military companies that give you plausible deniability to create messes, right? And that's kind of what that's one of the themes of high treason is that exact strategy of war, right? And it's fun. I make it taste like ice cream going down, and then you put it down, you're like, oh, now that could actually happen, right? But that is a way you can win. And it doesn't have to be state on state either. It could be, doesn't have to be China. It could also be, you know, very rich people. I mean, the top 60 most wealthiest people in the world own the equivalent of the bottom half of our world's population's wealth, right? I mean, you could fit them all into a single bus. And now some of those people transcend nationality. They think that they're a sovereign in some ways to the world. And they can now fight and win using sort of strategies that nation states have used, not with landing craft and aircraft carriers, stuff like that, but I mean like these other ways we're talking about. And so, you know, the relationship between money, influence, and power will not surprise any of your listeners. It's as ancient as dirt. We're just seeing it occur in new ways. And the problem, I think, is that Washington, D.C. is backwards facing. It's still stuck in the 20th century, its glory days. I think people around the country are not, but I think people in Washington are, these so-called experts, a lot of experts are. And I'm trying to bring them up to catch up with where everybody else is. And I use fiction and nonfiction to do it, because I do think that there are many ways to win, and they don't all involve bullets. And that's the question. It's like, how do you weaponize influence? How do you turn money into power, power into money, stuff like that?
One of the reasons I really like to bring you on here is because I have a knack for seeing the progression of things and going, and you do in a very big way. And there's a lot of people out there who are sort of coming to the realization that we're in the middle of a big snowball right now. And you can have disagreements about what the end result of that is. But I guess, you know, there's evidence, and everybody kind of knows this who pays attention to information, is that the three-letter agencies from their inception until this very day have had plants in different things and have run different kinds of operations and false flags and all this kind of stuff everywhere and here. And it's just sort of, it's like, well, no duh. If you have the capacity to do this, you're going to do it. If you want a certain outcome, you're going to do what it takes to get that outcome, especially when that's what you've been tasked to do in that way. And that's your specialty. So fine. But there are records that exist of a lot of this stuff. And, you know, they've kind of outed themselves, like, here's a FOIA, and I guess it's 50 years old. We'll just admit to this now. But with the other end of things, with this private end of things, it's even easier for something like, let's take the recent riots, for example. Right. People are very frustrated. They've been cooped up. They got cabin fever. There's been just a lot of bickering on the internet during this time. Well, you're dumb for wearing a mask. Well, you're a murderer, and all the grandparents are dying because you didn't. And all the political stuff and et cetera. And how much easier would it be for an outside force to just send somebody in there or to have a troll farm like you talked about? But I know for certain, because I know from conversations I've had with people who are involved in this kind of stuff, that there are exact same private companies here in the United States who are troll farms who influence things that way. I mean, that's sort of what a digital marketing agency is in a lot of ways. It's sort of like a troll farm for hire that has this sort of air of legitimacy around it because it's a corporation that influences things. But I guess my point is it doesn't really matter who our national enemies are because there's so much ability to influence things. If you have 1 million followers on Twitter, say, a lot of those are going to be people watching you from three-letter agencies. A lot of those people are going to be people watching you from these private firms. A lot of those are just going to be people buying into your shtick. A lot of people are going to be people looking to you to learn how to do what you're doing because they want to influence stuff as well. And I guess I'm wondering, knowing what you know and seeing how things operate the way that they do, It seems to me, and what, I mean, what do I know at a distance, but it seems to me to be the case that you're trying to do what you're doing with a certain set of standards. Like maybe you know how to play this game, but you want to play a different one and sort of stand in the face of this kind of storm. Because if you really wanted your stuff out there, you might play the same game they're doing and better and throw it in their face. And I guess I just wonder, what is it about you, or why is it that you're taking the stance that maybe doing this above board, being a teacher, being an author, coming on podcasts is the way to do it, rather than just playing a more effective behind the scenes yeah. game? Or maybe you are and I just don't know about it.
No, I do it because I'm an idealist. So I worked in the private military world as a high-end contractor, quote unquote. I also worked in the high-end private CIA world, for lack of a better word, of private intelligence. And that's a whole different world entirely. Now, there is some overlap between private military and private intel. But here's what I learned from doing that for many years, is that it's a lot scarier and more powerful than people know and think. And forget the agency, forget special operations forces. You can get that stuff on the market if you know where to look, right? And our enemies can hire American companies to do that against us as well, right? It doesn't have to be a Chinese company against us. So this whole idea of like the world is full of flags and that's how things are sorted, that world is wrong. I mean, that's part of it, but that's a sliver of it, you know? And what I want to do is I'm on a mission to pull back the curtain on that. You know, I could get wealthy by playing that game because I'm a vet of that. I've decided to do something different. I've decided to pull back the curtain. I want people, we need to understand what the world is around us. And that's what the New Rules of War is, the nonfiction. That's what High Treason, my fiction, tries to do. It tries to pull back the curtain and says, hey, here's the guy operating the Wizard of Oz, right? This is how it works. And the mission, if you will, is a purely ideological one that I believe that, you know, as Churchill said, democracy is the least bad form of government, to paraphrase. But democracies require information and interested and curious citizenship. And that's what I'm trying to foster, is share this information with people, let them make decisions. I don't have the hubris to think that I know best for everybody. Let's start a national conversation about how the world really works in terms of politics, not the world as we think we know it or the world we learned in sixth grade social studies. And that's kind of that's why I'm public about it.
I have a friend, and he's written a book that's very much about how the world works, and it's sort of undeniably true, but he's gone the sort of the John Galt route where he's in a mountain. He's literally in a mountain in Colorado, built his own home out there, and he just kind of sends cryptic messages out from his mountaintop container house that he built about the world is changing, and he just kind of laughs at how there's a failure to see that. And you're more out here in the world creating novel steels and trying to keep the rails healthy and the train moving. And I guess I wonder, you know, there have been a lot of idealists in the past who have been railroaded, and you're speaking in a sort of a pretty dangerous world in a lot of ways, and it's not great to have enemies in that world. And I guess I just wonder at what point you feel like you'll know that you've made a difference, and will you have the stamina, given everything that is involved in that world, to carry on as long as it takes?
Yeah. Look, I dealt with warlords in Africa for many years. So, yeah. You know, having some senator staff member threaten my career or whatever, you know, I've heard it all. There was a time in my life where I thought I was going to die. Like, not like, it's like, there's like, I will die the next year or two. The odds are against me living because of the things I was doing. And then I decided to leave that world, which was an interesting realization somehow I didn't have before, that I just walk away if I want. And it, you know, it wasn't as easy as that, but I did. And so I decided that, okay, well, what do you want to commit yourself to? Is it making, you know, more shekels? Well, no, not really. I mean, that's good. I want to be comfortable. You'll be comfortable, but that's not, I'm not deeply passionate about money the way, say, a banker is, right? So, you know, would I run for Congress? No, because if you look up close to it, you're just a slave, in my opinion, if you, you know, and that's what you have to, and if you make peace with that, that's fine. I'm not going to judge other people, but it wasn't the right path for me. And I've had a very self-directed path. My career has been invented, and it's had its shares of, you know, joys and tears as well, as everybody in life does. But that's, you know, at the end of the day, I want to be able to sit on my porch at age 80 and not look back and regret my life about what I chose to do. And so for me, that's what this looks like.
I like that. Part of the thing that's important to me in a life is that you live it in a way that you can look back on your life and not regret it. It's sort of how you measure the success of your life. So I think maybe, man, that's a good place to start working our way towards the end of the conversation, because that's an important point I maybe want people to stick inside of their heads as they're reading through this book, is it's not easy to have lived the life that you've lived to be able to write it. It's not easy to be the guy who's decided to stick to his principles and write the book. And it's not easy the guy to be after and say, look, if you want to come at me because I can handle this. I did this as a profession and I was successful at it. So if that's how you want to play, that's fine. But when your guy gets unelected in about 4 years, you're going to disappear and I'm still going to be here sharing the message.
Right.
So is there anything maybe that you feel like you would want people to take away from High Treason, the book, and from Dr. Sean McFate, the teacher, about just what it is you feel like they ought to take away from all of this?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, High Treason's a fun book to read. It's not like a preachy, sermony type of thing. It reads like a fast novel. But there is stuff in it that it has a message. It reveals where the contours of power really lie in a place like Washington, D.C. It's not what people outside D.C. think. I have been in D.C. for 20 years on and off. And the contours of inside D.C. is not what people think. And it in some ways it's worse. But it shows you the mechanics of that. And it shows you how we are vulnerable. In some ways, we're a very strong nation. In other ways, we're very vulnerable. And, you know, it reveals what those things are. And we can't, you know, Tom Locke's a fun character because he's a flawed hero and he's a realistic hero. He's not like the super, like this genre, you know, that the protagonists are supermen, like, you know, some version of Wolverine or something. Or they're just Boy Scouts, and he is neither. He's like all of us, except he's better with a gun, probably. But he doesn't just fight his way out of, he thinks his way out of situations too. And by following Tom Locke through that world, it's like a guided tour through what modern, you know, international relations kind of looks like. It's not stuff you see in textbooks. It's not stuff you hear in C-SPAN lectures. Tom Locke is like your Sherpa into the seedy and dark halls of power. But it's a fun read. You don't need to read the other books to get them. It's New Rules of War universe, but with Tom Locke as the protagonist running around. And also has a great female character called Jennifer Lynn, who's like a roguish FBI agent. And she is also on a similar track to Tom. They run into each other. But I also believe in having strong female characters, because in this genre, women are often treated like stock trophies. And that was not my experience in the field. There are some serious women warriors, but they're feminine. They're not like, forgive me, they're not like men with breasts. They are, you know, and so Jennifer Lynn she's based on, all the characters are based on people I know. And she's a lot of fun too. So in fact, there might be a Jennifer Lynn novel in the future too. So High Treason's a lot of fun, but it's more than just a beach read. It is it's a guided tour about how international politics works inside the Beltway and beyond.
Excellent. Well, look, I'm going to continue reading it. I'm enjoying it, and I like a fast-paced thriller, especially if it's got some useful things to think about embedded in there. And I suggest everybody go out and get it. And they also, they haven't already heeded my repeated advice to pick up the new Rules of War. They picked that up at the same time. And thank you very much for coming back on here. Like I said, you're always welcome on here. I like the conversations. I like to get to pick your brain. So the next book you got coming out, let me know. And just thanks for your time.
Thanks, Chance. It's always fun. I like our conversations too. I learned a lot too. Thanks.
Yeah, very good. Well, in that case, I've been Chance Lunsford. You've been Dr. Sean McFate. This has all been allegedly, and we are